My next guest is a wealth of knowledge on all things concerning Black women's health. So it's only fitting that she hosts a podcast of the same name. Dr. Rahman is a graduate of the Yale School of Medicine and has been a leader in the field of obstetrics and gynecology for over 25 years. Her boutique practice in Philadelphia has rave reviews, and her knowledge and expertise as a board-certified OBGYN is valued by many. Coming up next on the 40 Plus Files, respected physician and podcast host, Dr. Sharon Abdul-Rahman.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Rahman. How are you?
Good. How are you today?
I'm doing well.
Fantastic.
I'm just so happy to have you on the show today because you are considered an expert in your field, and I'm just excited about the knowledge that you're going to share.
My pleasure.
Yes, yes. So one of the first questions that I ask my guest is, how did you view aging or growing older when you were in your 20s?
Oh, that's a good question. I didn't think it was a positive. I think like most people, I thought it was best to be youthful. I thought that getting old was a negative, something that you frowned upon. Couldn't do the things that you used to do, couldn't remember the things like you used to, wasn't as strong, wasn't as pretty, really didn't seem to be good at all. But I've lived long enough to change my mind about that.
Yes, I love that answer. I love it. So you, like you said, you've lived quite a life. What was your biggest epiphany after turning 40 or 50? Did you have any epiphanies at any age?
Interesting that you said that. 40 was a breeze. 40, I was feeling like I was still in my 30s. Didn't notice a big difference. It was okay. 40, a breeze. 50 was traumatic. You start to realize that's a pretty big number. And you start to reflect, did I do everything I said I was going to do when I was 20? Mm. Am I where I want to be in my life? Or am I where I thought I wanted to be in my life? And I remember it was a sobering moment. And I remember not being happy about 50 until I remember I could be dead. You know, I mean, quite honestly, I was like, well, consider the alternative, you know, and I had to do a attitude correction.
Mm-hmm. So when did you finally embrace it, embrace aging then?
So I think it happened right around that time. You know, it was tumultuous because like, why am I not feeling good? 30 was a problem. 40 wasn't a problem, but 50 was a problem. And then I just had to, you know, for lack of a better term, just had to sit with myself, meditate, you know, about life in general. And then I started to appreciate everything that I did have, appreciate all the things that I have seen, acknowledge all the wonderful experiences that I have had. And when you start to just shift your attitude, how you see things change dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, you are, like I said, you are an expert in your field and respected in your field. I always wonder about doctors, if it's something that they've always known they wanted to be, or if it's something that kind of, you know, they happened upon. So you said that your father planted seeds for your future.
I realize that now. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it at the time. In fact, I thought it was just going right over my head, not paying any attention. He would just talk about his life. He would talk about his struggles. He even would share his disappointments. And one of it was, you know, I came north with these great big goals and aspirations, And I really, you know, I really wanted to be a doctor. And he would say it like that. And he wasn't saying, and I want you to do it, and I hope you do that. Never got said. It was just kind of in there. And, you know, and the conversation would go on. There was, it would be those conversations. My mother would always have a fairly big Thanksgiving dinner. And there was no dishwasher. And so it would usually be the two of us in the kitchen trying to figure out where we could put the food and washing the dishes. And in those long nights, that's when he would start telling these stories. And it was only years later when an opportunity presented itself, that seed that had been planted started to sprout.
Yeah, so you have quite a story about your educational journey. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's very interesting in that I wasn't one that thought since the age of four that I wanted to be a doctor. Wasn't that at all. No one in my family, immediate family, had graduated from college. And no, there were no professional doctors or lawyers in the family. In fact, I had this thought that that was beyond me. Mm-hmm. That wasn't something that I could aspire to, because doctors were these really smart people. And I had the opportunity to, and I say this in jest, but it really is true. I actually married a doctor, and I realized they're not that smart. I mean, they don't really, I mean, they're smart, but they're not that smart. And when the opportunity came, I finally felt like it was possible for me. And I say that in all seriousness. When they say representation matters, when you can see yourself in that position, then it becomes a real possibility. And through the benefit of being married to someone and being up close and personal, I was able to appreciate the fact that, maybe me too.
Okay. Yeah. Because you had actually started college, but then you dropped out.
I was a wayward student. I had lots of interests. I was the kind of student where they said, no more electives. You have to pick a major, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was all over the place. I had joined the Nation of Islam. I had dropped out of college because I had dropped out. I wanted to go to the University of Islam. I mean, I was kind of a wayward, let me see where this will lead me kind of path. And it was quite a journey.
Okay. Wow. So you know, during that time you got married, you had children. So what led you back to the college classroom?
Oh, reality hit home. I opened my eyes one morning and realized I was now the mother of two children. And I was either divorced or on my way to being divorced. And reality set in. I had to be serious about, now I had these two little ones, and I felt a tremendous responsibility. Whereas before, I think I was kind of flighty. Why not? Let's try this. Let's try that. Mm-hmm. Now there was two little ones that I had to be responsible for. And what was I going to do? I didn't have a college education at that point. Was I going to get a job? What kind of job was I going to get? And so that was a pivotal point in my life where I had to kind of buckle down and get serious about something finally. And that's when I made the decision that I would go back to school.
Yeah. So being a parent and a single parent at, you know, that point in time, that'll certainly do it. You know, nothing motivates
people
faster than having
to. Has a way. Yes.
Yes. So, well, that's a great thing, actually. So what led you down the path of medicine in particular? Because you had gone back, you knew you had to, you know, obtain a college degree. I mean,
I've always enjoyed the sciences. You know, I've veered off many different directions, but I often enjoyed the sciences and did fairly well in the sciences. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm going back to school. And they're like, okay, pick a major, will you? So I said, okay. And then it's like, well, what are you going to do? And I remember going to my college counselor and saying, do you think I could get into medical school? And the person said, I don't know. So it was like, well, let me try. I mean, and again, I go back to, I had the experience of being around doctors. And I was like, I think I can. I think I could do this. And so I applied. I mean, they were going to accept me or they weren't. And I would just, you know, deal as things presented themselves. And so I had the opportunity. I mean, it sounds kind of incredible. I don't even, you know, people say, but God, I had the opportunity to interview at Yale Medical School. Mm-hmm. And Yale is a very interesting place in that I think they admitted about 100 students each year. And they said, I mean, basically they said, if we accept you, that means we think you're good enough. Hmm. And the requirements, we don't rank our students, because in some medical schools, they rank you in terms of your grades. Yale said, we don't rank our students. We think you're all good. They said, you don't even have to go to class if you choose not to. Because the way we see it, this is your responsibility. If you choose to blow it, so be it. But we are not going to force you to do anything. You have three requirements for graduation. You have to pass National Boards Part 1, which is at the end of your second year, National Boards Part 2, and then you have to write a thesis. Those are the only requirements for graduation. What you do with your time, up to you. Mm. And so for me, as a mother with two children, that was wonderful. Because when I had to focus on being a mother, I could. I didn't have the day-to-day stress of where do I rank in class. And so it turned out to be probably the best place that I could have gone to medical school. And so that worked out really well.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't just any school, of course. It was the Yale School of Medicine. Did you
feel that helped too? I mean, that helped too. But quite honestly, there are other schools like I'm from Philadelphia and Temple University. They're medical school, but they rank students, and you had to take an exam every quarter or every so often, and that would have been extremely stressful.
Yeah. Did you feel any pressure as a Black woman at an Ivy League institution?
You always know you're Black. And you see, I remember things like the pride that people that worked in the mailroom or people that were in the cleaning would have for seeing not just myself, but other Black students in white lab coats. Mm. And that would make you feel good. I mean, so you always knew that. But I think there is a certain, sometimes you can be in places where if you're there, they kind of assume that you're not like the rest of them. You know, mm-hmm. You're special. Mm. And because you're special, we'll kind of give you the benefit of the doubt sometimes. Because you're not like them. And so you get a little of that because you can say, I'm from Yale. Mm-hmm. But the reality is you know.
Yes.
You know where you are and you know who you are.
Absolutely. So, of course, at this time, you definitely know that you're going into the field of medicine. Did you know which specialty?
I did not. I thought... So the first 2 years, at least back then, was that you're pretty much doing schoolwork. You're doing biochemistry. You're doing physiology. You're doing classwork. And then starting your third year, you go into the hospital and you do various rotations. You'll do internal medicine. You'll do pediatrics. And I thought I would have a eureka moment. I would say, this is it. This is what I've been waiting for. And that didn't really happen. I do remember when I did my OBGYN rotation, I was amazed. I couldn't believe that I had gone through that. You know, I had had children and it was like, oh my goodness, did that really happen? And so I do remember being fascinated by the miracle of life. Mm-hmm. The fact that an egg and sperm can come together, divide, and 9 months later, there's a person that comes out. The fact that a woman doesn't consciously have to do anything and her body will adapt and adjust to the pregnancy, to the growing pregnancy. Amazing. And if I ever have to get up in the middle of the night, let me get up for something that's positive, you know, life-giving. And so that was the thinking. I was just fascinated by the whole process. It's still incredible. Even the cardinal movements of labor, the way that head has to turn and flex in order to come through her bony pelvis is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And so all of those things just make you say, wow, amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a miracle. It really is a miracle. I used to wonder why, like, you know, when I was pregnant with my daughter, women who had had 2, 3, 4, 5 children, they would still be so amazed. They would see another woman carrying life. And absolutely. Now I know what that's, you know, absolutely. What that's like. And I'm like, wow, that's why I'm like, well, they've had children. Why are they so amazed by this?
It's when you stop and reflect on all the things that has to happen in order for a person to be born. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. Or the journey of the sperm, you know, millions mm-hmm. and millions of sperm, and what that sperm has to do to get to that egg. Phenomenal. And so when we say we're one of a kind, there is no other, that we are phenomenal miracles. I mean, it really is true. I mean, it's not hyperbole. The fact that we are here, you know, it is a testament to the magnificence of it all.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. So after choosing your field of study, you had a private obstetrics practice in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for a number of years. What resonated with you the most during that time?
Well, so there's another little story before that story. So in order to finance medical school, I agreed on taking what was called a National Health Scholarship. You would agree after your training to go to an area where there was a physician shortage. And so if you got 2 years, which is what I did, then at the end of my training, I had this 2-year service obligation where I had to, in exchange for paying for my education, mm-hmm. I would now work in an area that had a physician shortage. So I'm from the East Coast. And so I thought I would probably end up in Jersey. Mm-hmm. and then after the training is done, they kind of send you a list of, and these are the places. Mm-hmm. And I remember one place was Sitka, Alaska. And I was like, wow. And I was talking to the recruiter there, and she was saying, in our high-risk OB patients, we jet them to Anchorage. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. And then she was talking, and I was considering Sitka. And then at one point she said, oh, excuse me, I have to get my children. They're outside playing in the wilderness. And I'm like, wilderness? Oh, no. I'm a city girl. I don't think I can do wilderness. And so I ended up in Milwaukee.
Okay.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Inner city Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Had a need at a physician shortage. I was there for a couple of weeks, and the clinic closed. They actually went bankrupt. And there was an empty building, and I was given the proposition that if you would open up a clinic here, we'll sell you and give you this space and this medical equipment at a really good price. Mm-hmm. And at first I was like, no, I don't think that's it. But to make a long story, I eventually said yes. And so that's how I got into having my own practice. Hmm. And it was a learning experience. It was a big learning experience for me in that I had to, from a medical point of view, I had to know what I know and I had to know what I didn't know in order to get good care. And then that was one aspect. And the other aspect was the business aspect of having a medical practice. And I knew nothing about them. And that was kind of learn by the seat of your pants mm-hmm. kind of experience.
Hmm. So, I mean, how long did you stay in Milwaukee?
So all told, I was there for about 10 to 12 years. And by this point, my two daughters had gone off to college and they said they had come back to the East Coast and they said, we like it here. We don't think we're ever coming back to Milwaukee. And I was like, ugh. And then after right around that point, I decided that maybe I would try to come east. Maybe I would try to be an employee. You know, I had always been on the employer side and I thought the grass is so much greener over here. I think it's better if I'm an employee, you know? And so that's what I tried.
Okay. Yeah. So you're from the East Coast, Philadelphia specifically. So talk about your move back to Philly and why your focus became midlife care for women, because that's now your area of expertise.
I eventually also went to business school and got an MBA. Hmm. And for a while I thought, I'm coming out of this. I'm going to be a financial analyst dealing with healthcare or healthcare products. I don't need to do this anymore. Hmm. And so I was ready to go a different path. And right around that time, my father died. Hmm. And I remember thinking, how can you give up something that was so precious to him? Hmm. And so I said, oh, okay, I'm not going to do it. And so I said, all right, I will still be a doctor. I mean, there are a lot of things about being a doctor that I enjoy. I no longer will be doing obstetrics because for two reasons. The lifestyle is really hard when you're by yourself doing obstetrics because babies come whenever. Mm-hmm. And also the other reality is malpractice for obstetrics is extremely high. And I said, no, I'll just do GYN. Mm-hmm. And I said, I really like the focus on midlife female care, if we're talking about GYN, mm-hmm. because that's when the GYN issues start to become prevalent in that late 30s up to 50, 60 years old. That's when you start to have issues with abnormal bleeding, endometriosis, fibroids, decreased fertility, perimenopause, menopause, osteoporosis, incontinence. You start to see all these things in midlife female care. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I can deal with that. I'm personally in that age group. This resonates with me. You know, it's just knowing that or feeling that sometimes women, as we get older, we get dismissed, mm-hmm. you know, and feeling like, that doesn't seem right, you know?
Right.
That doesn't add up, you know? And so those were the reasons for thinking, you know, no, this is good. I mean, having a baby, carrying a life is phenomenal. But there's more to being a female than that, you know? Mm-hmm. And so just acknowledging that and recognizing that.
Absolutely. So I know that you said that you could identify with women in midlife because you had started to go through that yourself. And you also talked about female healthcare being somewhat ignored and women being taken advantage of and things of that nature. So did you also consider those things when you decided to focus on the gynecology part?
Absolutely. In addition to, you know, you experience it, you see it, you know, it's the relative importance that it's given, or the need to or the desire to dismiss it or not really talk about it are all things that seem to happen, you know, mm-hmm. or just doesn't seem to add up. I mean, the one thing that comes to mind while I'm saying this is we all have probably heard about Viagra and Cialis that's used for erectile dysfunction for mm-hmm. men.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not a whole lot available to talk about women's sexual dysfunctions, although it's presumed that women have greater sexual dysfunction than men.
Hmm.
You know, there's not a whole lot there. You know, only recently have medications have come out to address some of those issues. But so it's that kind of imbalance that you start to appreciate and say, I wonder why that is, you know? And so it's just if given the opportunity to shine a light on some of these issues, then I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you said that older women sometimes become dismissive of their female parts. Where does that come from?
That's a good question. Someone said, and it's interesting when you think about it, most female know what men genitalia looks like. Many women have never looked between their legs.
Hmm.
They can tell you what their own genitalia looks like, which is kind of odd.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of odd. Men know what their genitalia looks like. Women, not so much, not all the time. And interesting, they don't necessarily want to see it, you know,
mm-hmm.
which is an even deeper consideration, because why would you not? You know,
mm-hmm.
why would you not want to see that part of your body? What makes it unpleasant or repugnant to you? Or why would you feel that way? And so those are the kind of questions that come up. And those are the kind of things that make you want to go, you know?
Yeah, it reminds me of a scene from one of my favorite movies. It's called Fried Green Tomatoes. And... Mm-hmm. Kathy Bates's character goes to this women's assertiveness class, and the instructor tells them, okay, all right, ladies, get your mirrors and straddle your mirrors. And she's like, what?
No, I mean, it's a radical thought. It's a radical thought. I mean, but I think it's deeper. It's not just about sex and genitalia. It's about self-love
mm-hmm.
and self-worth. And feeling good about who you are in your body and being willing to take care of your body mm-hmm. because your body is what allows you to experience this earthly experience that we have. And so you have a better experience if you have a better body.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Just like if you have a better car, you might have a better ride, you know?
Yes.
And so it behooves us to optimize our health, to have, when I say better body, I'm not talking about a shape or size, but I'm talking about a healthiness, and to be committed to promoting your health.
Mm-hmm.
So that you'll have a body that's functional for you, so that you can experience this world.
Yes, absolutely. So I know that, you know, we're going to talk about some of your specialties, perimenopause, because I'm I've been going through that for a few years now, and menopause, which you have framed it as me, no pause. What made you frame the word in that way?
I wanted to take it from negative to positive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Menopause means the end of menses, the end of having a period. And there's something almost has a death quality to it. You know, it's over. It's all over. And so it was just, no, let's look at this. It's a transition. It's a different phase of life. It's not necessarily better or worse, but it's truly different. And so it's me, no pause. It's mm-hmm. just the same word, just looking at it differently.
Yes, I love it. And I'm like, I'm going to say the word like that from here on out. Me, no pause.
No pause.
Right. So speaking of that, so women go through perimenopause first, and then women are considered to have achieved menopause or gone through menopause when they have not had a cycle for 12 months. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I know that, you know, once women come to that particular time in their lives, they start to experience all kinds of changes in their bodies. And I've heard about hormone replacement therapy for years. I've seen advertisements and things of that nature. Can you talk about that a little bit? Is it safe? Are there any natural homeopathic alternatives? And how does a woman's diet affect certain perimenopausal symptoms? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's a lot. we have to back up and just kind of appreciate the physiology of it all, meaning that as women, we are born with all the aches that we will ever have. And when we hit puberty, our hormone level, which is estrogen, our main hormone, goes up. And it stays elevated as long as we are in our reproductive years. When we approach the perimenopause, that estrogen level starts to decline. And when it gets sufficiently low, mm-hmm. we stop having a period. Now, this hormone is produced by our ovaries. The ovaries produce the hormones, but we use our period as an indirect indicator that we have gone through menopause. So menopause is really not about the uterus stopping. It's about the ovaries have essentially depleted all of the eggs, no longer producing as much estrogen. And as a result of that, we stop having a period. And because most women don't just stop like that, things tend to space out. You miss a period, then you have it. You miss three periods, then you get it back again. Mm-hmm. And just when you think you're finally through, it comes back once again.
Yes.
So we say you have to go a whole year before you can say, I've really transitioned. I've gone through it. So it's almost like the end of the bookcase. When you're young, the estrogen level goes up. Average age is around 13. When you're about 50, the estrogen level comes down. So that's the symptoms that we experience are due to the decreasing estrogen or the low estrogen levels. And estrogen receptors are throughout our entire body. We have estrogen receptors in our heart. We have estrogen receptors in our brain. We have estrogen receptors all throughout our body. So menopause is really not just limited to our genitalia and our uterus. It's a full body experience. Mm-hmm. Some women, so even though the ovaries are not producing as much estrogen, in fact, they're producing a lot less estrogen, there are other parts of our bodies that can produce estrogen. So we're not totally estrogen deprived. We just have very low levels of estrogen. And we can see that effect. Our bones can get weaker as a result of having low estrogen. We can have the menopausal symptoms, the hot flashes, night sweats. Those are usually transient, meaning they do start, but they will eventually stop. The question is, when will they stop? They do eventually stop. And a woman has to decide for herself whether she needs assistance while she's going through that transition. And it's kind of similar to women and how they experience their menstrual cycles. Some women breeze through their menstrual cycles, don't have any problems. Other women have to stay in bed. Mm-hmm. And so it's a varied experience. And it's the same thing on this other end. It's a varied experience. Some women don't need much help. Some women need a lot of help to go through this transition. But that's the early stage of menopause. Eventually, the hot flashes and night sweats do lessen up, whether you take anything or not. But then there are late stages of menopause that we see, such as vaginal dryness, urinary incontinence sometimes, weakening of the bones. These are changes that we can see later in life. Mm-hmm. After she's no longer having hot flashes and night sweats. And again, what you do depends on the person and what she wants. You know, mm-hmm. if she is of an age where she is no longer having sex, doesn't plan on having sex, could do without it, mm-hmm. It probably doesn't matter that she has some vaginal dryness. It's not going to bother her. Okay. Mm-hmm. If she is petite and frail, she may be at an increased risk for osteoporosis. Mm-hmm. And so what you need has to be, what you get has to be tailored to what you need. There isn't a one size fits all type of recipe for this.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense because everybody is different. You know, some women experience them. You know, I've been perimenopausal for the past few years and not, you know, haven't hit menopause that point yet, but some of my friends don't experience hot flashes. I experience hot flashes, but they're on off. I'll go months where I don't have any, then they'll start back up again.
And there's so many different ways to approach it. Some women, and again, mindset is important. Some women call them power surges.
Yes. You know? That's what I had started calling them.
Yeah. You're having power surges. And all they do is they dress in layers. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm having a power surge. Something's coming off. Yeah. Or I'm putting something back on. Some women have noted that they tend to have more symptoms if they drink alcohol. And they're finding that changing how they eat or changing what they eat or just getting more meditative helps them to deal with some of these changes. And mm-hmm. so it's as varied as the female. And so there isn't a right or wrong way to go through. You just have to figure out what is it that you need, you mm-hmm. know, to continue to live your life.
Absolutely. It's about listening to your body because I know spicy food, I avoid it because spicy foods really, it just ignites those power surges. So I try to steer clear of spicy foods. Another one of my friends said that chocolate or caffeine will actually intensify them. So just, it's just about
everybody has has something that works or does not work. And that's good for you to figure out what works for you. Some women, there's been a recent study that say if a woman follows a vegan diet and eats soybeans, that in and of itself will help diminish her symptoms to the point that she doesn't need any hormonal replacement. Some women, that would never work. You know, that would never work. Some women absolutely do want hormones to help them through. So it's, there isn't a right answer, but everyone needs to understand the pros and cons, the benefits and the alternatives.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. So one of your specialties, you know, I know that people can find this out on your website, but what's the Mona Lisa touch?
The Mona Lisa touch is a laser device. It's a laser device to help women who are experiencing vaginal dryness. Vaginal dryness is really interesting. They say that women go to their gynecologists and they seldom talk about their sexual concerns. And they say that the gynecologists seldom ask. So there are those that either cannot or do not choose to use estrogen in any form. And so this has been suggested as an alternative. I do have to say that it doesn't have a formal FDA approval for such. And that's because the FDA has said it hasn't been tried and tested for a long enough period for us to totally endorse it. But the thinking behind it was it's giving women yet another option for to revitalize, to increase the blood flow to that area, diminish the vaginal dryness.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that you refer to some of your patients?
So we have a conversation about exactly, because a lot of times you don't know which came first, the decrease in libido or the vaginal dryness, you know, which was first. Mm-hmm. And so trying to sort that through is a big deal. And then usually if there's no contraindication, the quickest way to get a relief is through a topical estrogen cream. Mm-hmm. Now, some women don't want to do that. They'll just use a lubricant. Mm-hmm. And you can do that. There's lubricants and moisturizers. They are short term, meaning you have to use it. So there's two different ways I should say that. A moisturizer you should use every day, just like you would moisturize your face. Mm-hmm. You use a moisturizer down there. The lubricant you would use during the sexual act. And so for some women, that's sufficient. And it is true, you use it or lose it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is very true. The more active you are, the easier it is to maintain. If you're not as active, it becomes harder.
Right.
And so so there's the lubricants, you know, you can buy them over the counter. You can use coconut oil. You can use almond oil. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just want to lubricate it. And then if that's not sufficient, then there are other things.
This is all very helpful. I'm pretty sure that a lot of women are getting helped right now. So let's talk about fibroids, because I had a friend of mine on the show and she spoke candidly about her fibroid journey. What causes them and who are more susceptible to them?
So we don't know what causes them. Mm-hmm. And women all over the world can develop fibroid tumors. But African-American women here in the United States, and it's hard to speak about countries in Africa, partially because there's not a lot of data. But speaking of in the United States, Black women tend to be diagnosed with fibroid tumors at an earlier age, we tend to be more symptomatic from our fibroid tumors. And as a result of that, we tend to end up with more surgery. And so fibroid tumors are a big deal. And women find, Black women particularly, when they start talking among themselves or older females, it'll be, they'll say, yes, I had them too, you know, and I've had surgery. And so it is a big deal. What I've come to appreciate is that while most of us have heard the term, a lot of us are not really sure about what exactly it is. And there's a missing element of just understanding what's going on. You know, you kind of go into the office, you hear fibroids. I've heard that before. I'm not quite sure what it is, but I've heard that term before. And the next thing I know, someone's talking to me about a hysterectomy. And so there's a disconnect here. And so I see that as an area where women just need to better understand and better advocate for themselves. Fibroids are, so going back to anatomy, there is the ovary. The ovaries, we talked about them before, the ovaries have the eggs, and the ovaries produce the female hormone. So the ovaries are the main organ, female organ, right? You have the fallopian tube, which is the bridge that goes from the ovary to the uterus. Now, the uterus is this special muscle. It's a special muscle. It's an amazing muscle that can grow to accommodate a pregnancy. And then at a predetermined time can contract in unison so as to help to expel the baby and the placenta at a designated time. And all of this is without really any conscious effort for the mother, right? All of this happens.
Yes, you know, automatically.
Yeah. We don't set the time for the baby, for the uterus to start contracting. We don't do all that, any of that. And then somehow this happens. And then after accommodating this pregnancy and after helping to expel the contents of the pregnancy, it's able to contract down to a non-pregnant size. That's amazing. There's no other muscle in the body that can do all of that. The uterus does that. The uterus is composed of individual muscle cells. Now, a fibroid occurs when one of those cells starts to grow and divide abnormally. So a fibroid arises from a muscle cell in the uterus. And sometimes they get really big and grow on the outside. Sometimes they push in on the cavity. And so when a woman is sent for an ultrasound, that's kind of the first thing, you know, the doctor thinks you have fibroids, they're going to send you for an ultrasound. And the reason for the ultrasound, you want to know how many fibroids do you see, where are they located, and how big are they? And that helps to determine what type of treatment might be offered to the female.
Okay. So what are some of the best ways to manage them? I know that that probably varies.
It varies because it depends on what is the symptom. Because it is so common, a lot of times women will be told, if they're not bothering you, leave them alone. Do nothing. Okay. If you're symptomatic, one of the major symptoms is abnormal bleeding. And usually the bleeding starts at the expected time, but instead of stopping after about 6-7 days, you just continue to bleed and bleed and bleed. And the problem with bleeding and bleeding and bleeding is you become anemic. And if you become anemic, that can put stress on your entire body. And women sometimes don't make the connection. If she's anemic, why is she anemic? In an otherwise healthy female, no medical problems, if she's anemic, it's probably because her periods are too heavy. And the problem with that is we don't usually compare our flow with each other.
Right.
So how am I supposed to know my flow is normal or not? I have no frame of reference. There was actually a patient that ended up in the ER and needed a blood transfusion because she was so anemic. And they asked her and they did the evaluation. They realized she was anemic because she had heavy periods. And they said, didn't you ever go to the gynecologist? And she said, I go to the gynecologist every year. And they said, well, didn't the gynecologist ever ask you about your period? She said, every time the gynecologist would ask me, is my period normal? And I would say, yes, it's normal for me to bleed like this. And so that was the misunderstanding. It's like that question, compared to what? Mm-hmm. And so we say, you're bleeding too much if you bleed more than 7 days. You're bleeding too much if you are changing every hour. I'm talking about on your head. If you're changing every hour, you're bleeding too much. Mm-hmm. If you're wearing a tampon, it depends, and mm-hmm. you're padding yourself up, that's too much. Mm-hmm. And so if you're bleeding too much, then that will eventually lead to anemia. And anemia has all other consequences. And so anemia and bleeding too much is one of the big consequences, symptoms associated with fibroids. The other can be pain, depending on the size and the location of the fibroid. Mm-hmm. If you have a large fibroid that's pressing on your bladder, you might have urinary type symptoms. And so it depends. Also, depending on the age of the woman, fibroids could potentially interfere with her ability to get pregnant. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so what she needs in terms of treatment depends on what is the symptom, what is the concern, what are we trying to correct?
Right. I think that's one of the main concerns that my friend had. She said, she talks to women now because that is so true. And I never really thought about that. Women don't compare flow. But she said, all the things that you said, if you're changing your sanitary napkins every hour, that isn't normal.
It's not normal. And the other thing that doesn't get said is that the effect that something like that has on a woman, it affects the quality of her life. She's carrying change of clothes with her to work just in case she doesn't feel like she can be as social because she's worried that there might be an accident. I mean, all of this is a drain on a female. So it is a big deal. I think that Black women are starting to speak about it more, mm-hmm. like your friend. Mm-hmm. That needs to happen. There needs to be more research. I mean, we need to figure out why. Why is this? It may be that the way we eat and the way what's in our foods is contributing to that. More research needs to be done. There are just so many different avenues mm-hmm. that need to be investigated. And so we need to figure out why are Black women more prone to it? What is it? I mean, it's not okay just to say, oh, we've noticed this. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, now we need to figure out why. Yeah. Now we need to put some research, into learning more about the fibroids and what can be done about it and trying to be more proactive. Like, I don't want to wait until you have a hemoglobin of 4 and need a blood transfusion and you look like you're pregnant to then start talking to you about your fibroid. Mm-hmm. I want to diagnose it while it's still small so that we can potentially do something early that will prevent us ever getting to that point where we're talking about myomectomy, hysterectomy, and all those other type of things.
Yeah. And I think it's unfortunate because she said that she, believes that she slipped through the cracks. She said that, when she first started her cycle, which is at age 13, she was not diagnosed with fibroids until she was in her early to mid 20s. So by that time, she had 4 large fibroids. And looking back, she said that it was probably more or less you know, her lack of asking questions, you know, when she went to the gynecologist or whatever have you. But she says no one ever asked her about her cycles and them being heavier than they should be or things of that nature. So
the tricky question, it's how you ask the question.
Okay.
You know, if you said to your friend, are your periods normal? She would probably say, yep, it's always like this. Mm. It's my normal cycle. Mm-hmm. Not understanding if that's not normal. That's mm-hmm. too much.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, I know that a lot of women have dealt with fibroids over the years. You know, like you said, they mm-hmm. affect Black women more. So can women with severe debilitating fibroids ever overcome them and actually bear children?
There are lots of different procedures. Every woman needs to get a consultation. She needs to know what are her options. And for some women, it's possible. And for some women, it's not as likely. I mean, and that's the reality of it. And so there isn't one individual treatment that will cure our problems. A lot of Black women tend to have what are called surgical procedures called myomectomies, where mm-hmm. you remove the fibroid, keeping the uterus in place. Which doesn't solve the problem, because the problem is what caused the fibroids in the first place. Mm. Doesn't really solve the problem. And it's estimated that almost 50% of the time, the fibroids will grow back.
Well, one of the reasons why I definitely wanted you on the show is because of your podcast called Black Women's Health. It's a wonderful podcast. Let's just, you know, let me preface it by saying that it's a wonderful podcast, because this is just, you know, people are listening to this today. It's just a little bit of what they'll get from your actual podcast. What do you hope your listeners will gain from your show, Black Women's Health?
The reason it was started is because a lot of times when you hear about Black women's health, it's dismal. You know, we're the worst of the worst. We have the most problems. It's
yeah.
it's like, I don't want to hear it, because mm-hmm. then I think, well, why try? Mm-hmm. You know, the outcome's going to be worse. If there's an infection, we're going to get the infection more than anyone else. If there's a problem, we're going to have it worse. How is that uplifting? And so it was like, no, let's talk about Black women and Black women's health in a more positive way. Let's show Black women who are coming together, that are mm-hmm. being supportive of each other. There was this great podcast where it was great because she was devastated when she found out that she had triple negative breast cancer. But the response of the sisterhood that came around her was a beautiful thing. Or you start to hear about Black women doing things that you're like, really? Mm-hmm. We're there? And so it's like uplifting, or the very fact that it was two Black women reporters who talked about, wait a minute, Black people are actually more affected by COVID than what was being reported. Because initially the thought was somehow we were immune. And then the reality of it was, no, that's not true in fact. But it was two Black female reporters that started doing that. And so when you start to see that we are everywhere moving and doing, it makes you feel good. It mm-hmm. makes you feel empowered. And so that's what the goal was, to give it in a way that you don't feel dejected, hopeless, and defeated, but a way that you feel like, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what it does. So I'm so glad that you are doing that and sharing so much of yourself with the world in that way. But you also have your own practice, and you call it a boutique practice. So talk a little bit about that.
It's a very small practice. I say it's the difference between a department store and a boutique. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you actually need to go to the department store. You're going to find everything you want in the department store. But sometimes what you want is that extra special attention that you get in a boutique. Mm-hmm. And that's what we try to do.
Okay. So how do, well, let me ask you this first. What are some of the biggest advantages of doing what you do at your age? And what are some challenges?
Well, doing it this way at my age, I get to, it's not just about the anatomy and the pelvis and the vagina. I actually get to talk to the woman. I get to see her. I get to hear her story. And women have some phenomenal stories. Mm-hmm. I've heard some stories. I mean, and really, really impressive stories. What mm-hmm. women have gone through, what women do, the struggles they have, how they make it work. And so to be privileged to hear those stories is always, always nice. Mm. I like doing pelvic exams on first time, very first time. I've never had a GYN exam. And they come in scared that it's going to hurt. It's so painful. They've heard all these horror stories. And it's trying to break the myth. It doesn't have to be painful. It doesn't have to be a horrible experience. And trying to make that first time a positive experience instead of a negative experience. I think I like the thought of that. I hope that that sets the tone for all future visits, because women sometimes come in with these real irrational fears about how horrible it's going to be. Hmm. And it shouldn't be. And I don't force it on anybody, because it's that whole, it's a fine line between forcing a genital exam and being abusive. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, no. If either we will do it in such a way that it's not painful, or we won't do it. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. And it's really important to have someone who's caring and compassionate. Definitely. What advice do you have for women who are over 40 and think that their best years are behind them?
I say, I too thought that briefly, but the reality is that you get to this age and you realize you've been through stuff. You know stuff. Mm-hmm. You have a certain amount of wisdom just having lived. And if you're taking care of your body, you still should be quite functional. Mm-hmm. So these can actually be the best years of your life. You're not as self-conscious that as you might have been in your 20s. Hopefully you know your body and you know what you like. And hopefully you might have some discretionary cash that you can now do things with. And so it can be a wonderful time, not only for yourself, but to set an example for those who are looking at you. And they can see it's not a bad thing at all.
Wow. Well, it's been an absolute joy having you on the show today. How can people find you or get in touch with you?
So there is the podcast, and that's Black Women's Health. And my website is drramon.com, and that's pretty much it. Yeah. There's an Instagram account, but I don't use it that much.
Well, that information can be in the show notes. You do have the boutique practice, and it's in Philadelphia?
Yes.
Okay. So, but all of that information is actually on your website as well. Well, I just want to thank you again, Dr. Rahman, for sharing your 40 plus power with us and sharing your expertise. It has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for the invitation. It's been my pleasure.
Dr. Rahman continues her commitment to educating Black women about the importance of understanding their bodies and their minds. She is the founder of Today's Woman, a unique boutique gynecological practice in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Her specialties include care to women in midlife and menopause, uterine fibroids, and all aspects of sexual health. For more information about Dr. Rahman and her practice, you may visit her website at www.drramon.com.
For more information about the podcast, send inquiries to info@the40plusfiles.com. Don't forget to follow the podcast on Instagram at The 40 Plus Files. You can also follow my blog at www.wordyprofessor.com. Until next time, 40 Plus Phenoms, keep on shining.